Well, it's that slow flow. D-O-double-G, nigga. See these other fools, but you can't see me.
Let's take another one.
Can we get a motherfucking moment of silence?
You're back now at the Jack Off Hour. This is DJ Easy Dick. On the balls right now.
Oh, shit. Is that Snoop over there? Oh.
6 million ways to die. Choose one.
When I hear a track like this, the first thing that comes to mind is Tom Cody. Tom Cody, welcome back to the podcast.
Hello, all. Happy to be back again. Been making more frequent guest appearances. Been enjoying it.
Yeah, you know, people. I think people like you. I don't know. Nobody's come off and said, "Hey, don't have that guy back." I mean, it's not like you're playing video games while you're recording this, are you?
Yeah, I guess Gleb and some other guys had bigger problems with their audio, so at least I got that going for me.
Well, Gleb's problem was that he was living in Russia. Also, that he makes no sense.
That's a lot of problems.
That is a problem, and that his takes are... I mean, I wouldn't even say that they're spicy. They're just kind of out of left field.
Yeah, kind of non sequitur sometimes.
Yeah, so let's kick things off. What was your first takeaway from the Errol Spence fight? Or in general, what was your takeaway from the fight? I mean, it was one round, so I mean, literally 2 minutes and 59 seconds is the moment basically when Ocampo goes down, and then obviously he doesn't get up. So what is your initial takeaway from that long fight that we had?
My very honest answer is that shows like how close I've gotten to some of the stuff that we do was first like, oh man, that's not even enough footage to make like a highlight GIF. And I feel like I actually made a pretty good one. That'll be on Reddit on Monday morning, and it's on our Facebook page already. But yeah, it's like there were some good angles in there. It's got a good KO GIF. Also, I think more than that, I was much more interested in how the promotion was done. I thought that was really interesting that they really went heavy on the Dallas Cowboy angle. I feel like the way that it was presented almost felt like a pay-per-view, that you know they had these two much lower profile undercard fights, and they really spent like between those rounds and between those fights really playing up this like, you know, Spence stardom on the rise angle, the Dallas Cowboys angle, interviewed the Dallas Cowboys quarterback, had Jerry Jones in the ring after the fight. Yeah, I thought it was really interesting. I think it was very effective for basically like, you know, we'll get into some of the details, but we were very open and in agreement last week that Ocampo was not a very good fighter. He ended up as the mandatory due to basically other fighters not wanting to fight Spence. So Ocampo was the you know, the top of the totem pole out of the people who were willing to accept the challenge. We knew he wasn't very good. I wasn't expecting a first round knockout. You know, he was pretty unknown.
I actually predicted first round knockout. I don't usually make predictions, but in the Discord, I was asked, what's your prediction? And I was like, knockout one. And everyone's like, no, four through six after seven. And I was like, one. So I was very happy about that. But go on.
Yeah, my very quick take is just, yeah, I thought that was interesting. I knew in advance he wasn't going to be a great opponent, so it was really more interested to see how it was all going to be presented. Again, very quick KO, but I think overall still a successful event. Lots of tickets sold. I think everyone who bought a ticket to that event got what they were paying for to see the hometown hero get a big KO win. So, yeah, it would have been nice to see more out of Ocampo. I mean, he was totally unknown. Before the fight, Derek James, Spence's trainer, who also trains Jermell Charlo, said, this guy's really unknown, doesn't look that great on tape, but really it's just going to be a matter of how durable he is and how much he wants to be in there as far as how long the fight lasts. And I think we learned that at least about Carlos Ocampo. You know, he got hit by some massive body shots throughout the first round and then a pair of body shots to finish it off right at the 259 mark. And, you know, if you're not getting up from a knockout at 259, that means, you know, they could have counted to 100 and you were never going to get up if, you know, you couldn't get up and take that 1 minute rest. Anyway, yeah, but what's your hot take? What's your take on the fight?
Well, I do want to say, first of all, that the Dallas Cowboys thing was really nice to see. Now, obviously, I didn't need to see it. You didn't need to see it. And if you're listening to the podcast, you didn't need to see it. But that whole thing wasn't for us. It was for casual fans who are getting exposure to Errol Spence, and maybe they don't have as much exposure to him as we do. And what that was providing credibility for him. When you have the Dallas Cowboys, a quarterback of the Dallas Cowboys, Dak Prescott, you have... maybe Jerry Jones right there. It gives credibility to Errol Spence in a way that very few fighters can get credibility. So it really played up Spence and kind of began the transition from Errol Spence being a boxing star, and a boxing star is a guy who can do a good number but isn't great, like it's not breaking any records, from a boxing star to a sports star. And I'm telling you, having Dak Prescott there doing that interview, it that stuff goes viral. That stuff gets out there. And it brings Errol Spence into a different category, and I really enjoyed that part. It was just really cool to see, by the way, they pulled the curtain back on the Dallas Cowboys, and they showed us all this stuff, and it was like, you know, it was nice to see that. Now, about the actual fight, we talked about this before, and you said something about how Rayfield and who else was it?
Oh, do we want to recap this?
Yeah, yeah. Because look, I've said this before. We'll put a pause on that real quick. I've said this before. What do you learn from a first round knockout? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. It could be that Ocampo took a shot and it did put him down, and he was just like, "Well, I'm not getting up from this. I don't want any more of that." It could be that. It could be that Spence is really, really strong and Ocampo has a really, really bad chin. Any combination of those things, but it's all speculation. We didn't see that Spence showed off any defense. We didn't see him set up, lay traps, and that paid off later. It was literally just, it knocked him out. Ocampo didn't get up after, you know, what are we gonna learn from that? I think we can go into this other thing about these tweets that we saw from Dan Rayfield and who was the other guy?
Mike Coppinger. Well, I don't hate both of them. I think, you know, they're both good boxing writers, but I think they were a little too eager to have a hot take last night to justify to their editors, you know, why they flew down to Dallas for, you know, 3-minute fight.
So that definitely has a part of it. And the crux of the argument was that the IBF is pathetic, they're horrible, they should be punished.
Should I read the tweet?
Oh, I mean, that'll probably be better than me making it up.
Sure. So this is Dan Rayfield's tweet from last night right after fight. That the IBF made Ocampo the mandatory for Spence is a sick, disgusting, pathetic joke. Shows off once again how genuinely bad their rankings usually are.
Honestly, if you took out a couple of nouns that would make that boxing specific and just put blank spots there where you can fill in the blank and you say, who tweeted this? What would the answer be? You already know. Go ahead.
Very Trumpian.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It'd be a very Donald Trumpish tweet. And it's basically Donald Trump tweets read like clickbait headlines. So anyway, about that whole thing, should the IBF be punished? Was this such a horrible thing? I think, look, mandatories work a very specific way. And it's obviously not the perfect like solution in boxing. But there's a logic to it that makes it work, that boxing has used for years and years and years and does not have a problem with. And just because the fight ended in a first round knockout or stoppage, that doesn't mean that the entire system is broken. So you take a guy like an Isaac Dogbe, who just recently beat Jesse Magdaleno. But Dogbe looked like in the same position. He was basically Carlos Ocampo, a guy who'd mostly fought in his home country against nobody. He would have never gotten a world title shot. Dogbe, that is. He would have never gotten a shot if they wouldn't have gotten into mandatory position. That's it. He would have never, and that was a great story to see. It was a great fight. And sometimes these guys rise to the occasion. And sometimes they don't, but isn't like, you could say the same thing about all the world level fighters. I mean, sometimes they rise to the occasion, and then sometimes they're Kell Brook when Errol Spence comes to your hometown. Now, I want to share a story that's like, you know, I'm going to take you behind the curtain for a second, okay? So I was at a press event, and this was before Spence had gotten his title opportunity. He had fought, he had just beat Leonard Bundu, and I was talking with Sam Watson, and the fight against Bundu had put Spence in a mandatory position. And Watson was telling me, like, look, we're gonna get this Brook fight and we're gonna knock him out. And then so the conversation was like, okay, well, you know, if you're confident that Spence is gonna knock out Brook, then like, what's next after that? And like, Watson was like, look, nobody wants to fight Spence right now, and that's why we're fighting Brook, because nobody else wants it. We love to fight other guys, but they just don't want to fight Spence. You know, Pacquiao, that's a no. Bradley's not stupid. He knows that Spence will retire him. Nobody wants to fight Spence. And, you know, we may have mentioned some other names that you've heard of, and those guys were a no to the fight with Spence. And I bring this up because the point here is that if Watson is right, and I'm not going to say he is, I'm just going to say if he is right, that all these guys rejected the fight, when you have a guy like Spence, that basically means that if you have a guy like Spence who's dominant, they will never get title shots because they pose a risk-reward threat that puts every champion into a major dilemma. And it's just tough for a guy like Spence to get a world title shot if you don't go through the rules that state you are guaranteed a title shot if you play by these rules. I mean, I don't know why that's so difficult, why that's a broken system just because one guy gets knocked out in one round. I mean, I know you agree with me, but do you see any holes in my argument?
No, and I mean, really, I'll just elaborate from my own point of view. I mean, it's really ironic to say that because, as you said, you know, IBF mandatories are the reason why Errol Spence is now a champion. He was an avoided fighter coming up. People viewed him as too much risk for the reward. Kell Brook was in kind of a similar situation, which is why Kell Brook had some famously terrible mandatories himself. I mean, the other reason Kell Brook got shit for that is his voluntary against Frankie Gavin during that stretch of time was pretty terrible as well. Kell Brook was an avoided-ish fighter. Spence got in that mandatory slot. He fought an eliminator against Leonard Bundu, as you said, won the title. And then, you know, now he's found himself in the same situation. People still don't want to fight him. So fighters, if they're choosing which title belts they want to get in the rankings for, so they can eventually earn a mandatory slot for, you know, that belt. Basically, everyone in the division decided they wanted to go for Keith Thurman, which now resulted in one of those belts being stripped off, which is now going to be Danny Garcia, Sean Porter fighting for that belt. And then Top Rank, they own the WBO effectively. So Crawford is just, you know, Pacquiao had the WBO belt, kind of got a title shot for that undeservedly. Jeff Horn ended up with it. Now Terrence Crawford has it. And, you know, that's kind of just the other side of the street. But yeah, I mean, you know, you sort of go up and down the sport. I mean, the IBF follows their rankings. If you have a good fighter, but one who's potentially avoided, they have a chance to go in the IBF. And, you know, just on that note, you know, Yordeni Ugas is a guy who's, you know, very serviceable fighter, very talented, very avoided, but he has some losses on his record. He's also Cuban, not marketable at all. He has been very vocal that he's in the IBF and he's trying to get Spence's slot. He kind of ended up missing this fight, the Carlos Acampo slot for this fight by about 6 weeks. Ugas, in a very odd twist, ended up being ranked higher than Ocampo, but Ocampo had already earned the mandatory slot. So Spence had to fight Ocampo, but now, you know, Ugas, who's an avoided fighter, is banging the drum trying to get the Spence fight. And also, just interestingly, I mean, to bring this full circle, the whole thing of the Ocampo fight was, you know, again, Spence being viewed as too much risk for the reward, people not wanting to fight him, people not wanting to get in the rankings in order to earn a mandatory slot. That's pretty much shifted now. You know, we talk about his ticket sales for the Lamont Peterson fight, talk about the whole event going on with the Dallas Cowboys. It's looking like Spence is going to have a voluntary defense in the fall before fighting a unification against Garcia Porter winner at the beginning of 2019. That was kind of an update. I think a lot of people thought Spence's next fight would be that winner, but Showtime and Spence indicated there's going to be one more fight in between. And it looks like the fight in between, if you look at the IBF rankings, is either going to be Jesse Vargas or Devin Alexander. Much more likely to be Jesse Vargas, Spence said. I don't think he said this on the broadcast, but he said it in like internet videos, like Fight Hype videos like that, that he wants Jesse Vargas in the fall. So Very likely Spence is going to fight Jesse Vargas, probably at the Barclays Center sometime in the fall, and then fight a unification against the Garcia-Porter winner next spring. And then, you know, after that point, Spence has crossed the risk-reward barrier. He's now a star. So going forward, fighters are actually going to get into his mandatory slot and get in those rankings because, you know, again, it's fighters fight. You know, it's not a matter of being afraid. It's a matter of wanting to make money. So if they feel they can actually make money fighting him, now he's become he will have become arguably a bigger draw than Keith Thurman, or at least a comparable one. Mm-hmm. Fighters are going to want to get in those slots, take those fights again, like Jesse Vargas now already in those rankings, Devin Alexander. It's amazing, which is really just to cap this off, how quickly that balance has shifted with Spence. Coming out of the Kell Brook fight, couldn't get anyone to fight him. Based on the numbers that came in for the Lamont Peterson fight, you know, which, by the way, my take on that fight was Errol Spence's stardom has arrived. That's what my headline was when I did the post-fight article after that fight. And, you know, that really has played out. The risk-reward balance has shifted. People feel they can make money fighting him. They now are seeking him out. And, you know, I don't think we're going to see another Carlos Ocampo, I think, from here on out. I mean, really, unless, you know, at some point moving up to a future weight class, he really shouldn't have to fight a guy at that level again.
Yeah, you know what's really funny that this is just not going to help? Is that the rehydration.
Oh, this is an interesting topic. Yeah, go on.
Spence is considered one of the big welterweights in the division. This guy's not even rehydrating 10 pounds. He rehydrated 8 or 9 pounds. This, like, people forget that Spence is not as young as you think. He's a young guy, still one of the younger guys in the sport, but he's not going to fill out like Jermell and Jermall Charlo were, or he's not going to fill it like Canelo, because Canelo was obviously, you know, in his early 20s. Spence is in his late 20s. And this guy is here at welterweight to stay unless he figures, well, I want to go up and wait so that I can achieve more things. But as far as being a welterweight is concerned, like, he's here to stay. And that just I think that makes it more dangerous that he's not rehydrating a lot and he's still destroying guys. I mean, that's all I really wanted to say about that. I just wanted to make sure that that was said. But I definitely agree with what you said. I do think that Spence's stardom, that I believe is on the rise, and the Dallas Cowboy stuff definitely added to that, is going to basically tip the risk reward factor into he will become a worthy risk. The other thing that I had to say about this fight really is that the fight wasn't competitive. We both agree with that. I mean, a first round knockout usually tells the story. But I'm not upset with that because I don't think that there's any opponent apart from the two that you know that will be competitive with Spence. That every single opponent that Spence gets in the ring with is going to, at the end of the fight, look just like all the rest. There's not a competitive fight at all. Danny Garcia won't be competitive with Spence. Sean Porter won't be competitive with Spence. It's a simple fact. It's just a simple fact. I don't think those are competitive fights. So every fight is just going to be a mismatch. It's going to end up the way this one does. And really, the only fight that's really close is the Crawford fight, because Thurman will be an underdog. So, like, get used to not really respecting the opponents as far as their ability to challenge Spence, not really respecting the opponents that get in the ring with Spence. You think that's crazy to say?
I mean, I've got a bunch of things to respond to there. So I'll in reverse chronological order. So just so what you said most recently, and then I'll work my way backwards. That's one of the things I get most frustrated about as far as like boxing writer hot take. You know, that was something I think Gennady Golovkin carried around, I think, unfairly, when people said, oh, you know, it's okay for him to fight Dominic Wade. Well, Dominic Wade was a mandatory, so that's poor example given the conversation we've been having. But, you know, it's okay for Golovkin to fight terrible fighters because, you know what, all these fights would look the same. And I totally disagree with that logic in general. I mean, I think that's not really what you mean, that they would all look the same, but you're saying they wouldn't be competitive. But, you know, what we saw with Golovkin, when he fights you know, Martin Murray or Daniel Giel or Marco Antonio Rubio, who's coming in with, you know, six losses. Very unheralded Marco Antonio Rubio, just a long time, you know, journeyman at the very fringes of the world level. Yeah, people said, oh, it doesn't matter who he fights, these are all going to look the same. And something that really infuriated me, I mean, there was a big Reddit boxing meetup going to the Daniel Jacobs fight. I went to that. A lot of other people there, you know, other Sunday Punch regulars. Leo was there. Graham was there. shout out to other boxing mod Dean had flown in even from England. And the prevailing consensus there was, oh, Daniel Jacobs might be Golovkin's best opponent up to that point, but it doesn't matter. It's going to look exactly the same. He's going to get an early knockout. And
yeah,
we know
didn't
that
listen
it didn't
to this
play
podcast.
Out that way. Well, yeah, I mean, right. I you know, I'd like to think that we knew better. I mean, or at least you, I wasn't on the podcast at that point, but, you know, it was definitely my attitude at that time and didn't play out that way. I mean, I think, I would pick Spence. I mean, he's my top guy at welterweight, even above Crawford, which is a whole other conversation. But I mean, Crawford has certainly a case that you think he's going to have a competitive fight with Spence, could beat Spence. Thurman, I think as well. And even the Sean Porter, Danny Garcia, I think those are very likely to be distance fights. You know, I would not in any way say those are guaranteed knockouts. So, yeah, you know, it does make a difference. I mean, coming into this, if you listen to last week's show, we said Carlos Ocampo is not only not great. I mean, you would have to go back like 3 years in Spence's career to when he was really a prospect, to when he was fighting that level of opponent. I mean, he's really just a level below. And it did play out like that, you know. So just to touch on a couple of other points. Regarding the stardom thing, I just want to talk about that a little bit more regarding the Dallas Cowboys. I think that's really interesting. You know, you see territory like where Terrence Crawford is in Omaha. There's nothing else in Nebraska. You know, all they really have is the Cornhuskers, and then, you know, that's it. They don't have professional football. Dallas Cowboys is a big sports market. So I think a lot of boxing writers have been calling out for a number of years saying, why, you know, really banging this drum. And this was more of really the anti-PBC people, if we're being honest, but saying, why isn't Al Haymon, why isn't the PBC, why aren't they developing Spence in Dallas? And I think it was this extremely calculated decision that Dallas is not going to bring Spence up. You know, if he tries to go there before he's big enough, just no one's going to care. That's not going to work out well. But if he can become a big enough attraction, if he can reach a certain level and he can actually bring something to the table, people are really going to embrace him. And I think like that's something, if people have wondered, you know, why hasn't he done this? This has very much been my thought. You know, it's been sort of my rebuttal for the last few years saying, why haven't they brought him back to Dallas? It was that, you know, they want him to be a world champion. They want to build him up to a certain level and then he can make a big homecoming splash.
I mean, to add to your point, like, no one does it that way. Like if you look in other like entertainment mediums or vehicles, you start with LA and New York and then you work out. Nobody starts. I mean, it's rare, probably. It doesn't happen very frequently where you start in a small and a hometown venue because the big markets like LA and New York basically dictate the rest of the country. So you can go on though.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and I'll just even add a point related to that. I mean, it's like people looked at the PBC having so many fights at the Barclays Center and say, why do they do this? I mean, this is still, you go online and, you know, that Steve Kim's take was, oh, you know, I was right all along. You should have been fighting in Dallas. And it's like, no, I would, you know, disagree. I mean, they had this much bigger plan of let's build up, really almost getting back to like, you know, we always like to talk about wrestling, but wrestling with the territory days. They really built up the Barclays Center as, you know, a territory, basically. They built up the Barclays Center as being a venue for boxing bigger than a single fighter, that they could bring Adrian Broner there. They could bring ultimately Errol Spence there. Keith Thurman, Danny Garcia, Sean Porter, really build up that market. And then once the market is built up, that, you know, it's a rising tide raises all ships. Once they've built up that market, they can use that as a way to bring their fighters to prominence. I mean, the Charlo brothers have really done some great stuff on the undercards there, where they moved a lot of tickets and they've come up to a level where they're, you know, bursting at the seams to become headliners. So, yeah, I think they're very wise in bringing Spence up before they came back to Dallas. And like I said, this has been kind of looming for the last few years. And, you know, you already said, and I totally agree. I mean, they greatly exceeded my expectations, the amount of buy-in they have from the Dallas Cowboy organization. And as was widely said on the broadcast last night, anyone with a brain, you know, can put two and two together. The ultimate goal here, I mean, you know, look, let's look at Golovkin at MSG. fought at MSG in the theater, which is a 5,500 seat room, fought in the main room, fought in the lower bowl. And then ultimately in his last fight at MSG, when he fought Daniel Jacobs, fought in the main room with the full room open, sold the whole thing out, around 20,000 tickets. You know, that's kind of the model. You want to, if you have a guy who's really a ticket seller, you can, that's, you know, well, actually there are multiple ways of doing it, but one way of doing it, again, if you really believe in their stardom, is you want them to burst out of the scenes, burst the seams of a room. So you want to sell out. So then you have everyone there is, you know, feels privileged to be there. There are people who wanted to be there but couldn't be there. The tickets are going up on the secondary market. So, you know, if you can do that, if you have a guy who really has the star potential, if you don't, doesn't really make sense, but if you do, so, you know, you had that model. So you're already seeing in Dallas, okay, great. So he was the first fight at the Dallas Cowboys practice field. Okay, well, what about the next fight? You know, everyone there was ecstatic with his knockout result. So great. So he's bursting out of the seams. There are sort of conflicting numbers. It's either somewhere between 12,000 or 14,000. So those two separate numbers.
I saw the 12,000 number. And I think the actually purchased attendance.
Well, right. So one of the numbers might have been purchased versus attendance if they had cut. You know, it's like, sometimes hard to read between the lines there, but anyway, you know, good numbers sold out the way that room was configured. They might be able to reconfigure it to a couple thousand more tickets, or maybe for the next time he's in Dallas, they said they want to make this an annual thing. Maybe he'll fight his next fight in New York and then maybe go back to Dallas, and now they'll do some version of a configuration of, you know, the main field at for the Cowboys, depending on who the opponent is. So yeah, it'll be really interesting to see how that grows. I mean, this was definitely a long-term plan. I mean, Jerry Jones was not there because to show Spence at the practice field. I mean, the idea was, you know, we believe in him as an attraction for, you know, the main Dallas, what is it, AT&T Stadium, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's the ultimate goal here. They're working backwards from a fight that sells out or at least does very well at Dallas Cowboys Stadium, which can seat many, many thousands. I don't know what the total attendance could be. I'll just Google that real quick. But
100,000. So I mean, he's still a ways from getting to those numbers. But you know, in terms of the long term,
but here's the thing: if it's a long term plan, right now, or what they did to sell these tickets is they went to all their season ticket holders for the Dallas Cowboys, and they used them to leverage them into buying tickets. Now these people have, you know, they went and they bought their tickets and they spent their money, and after a first round knockout, they start talking. You know, how did Mike Tyson grow? The guy wasn't terribly charismatic. He didn't make people feel safe.
That's debatable.
He didn't make people feel safe.
Definitely didn't make people feel safe. That's for sure.
But Spence has that quality to him. I mean, Spence has a quality that just people, you can't help but watch him. He has that star aura. You know, very few fighters have it. He has it. And he doesn't have to talk trash. I mean, he reminds me of Sugar Ray Leonard. And so with all that, you know, put together, I think that all those season ticket holders, they go and they talk about Spence, and Spence becomes a thing that grows over in Dallas. Now, here's the thing, the difference between what this plan is and then what Eddie Hearn does, because it's similar in that Eddie Hearn has grown these local attractions in the UK. Well, he basically does it by just putting on multiple fights in their hometown and then letting it build gradually. This reminds me of what the Dodgers did. So the Dodgers were purchased by a new group several years ago, and the Dodgers were a decent team at the time. You know, they cracked the playoffs and stuff, and the team completely wanted to change the business aspect of the Dodgers and how they signed players, the type of players that they signed, et cetera, et cetera. And so one of the things that they did is they wanted to build from the developmental level, I guess we could say, for boxing, for you know, be the minor league system. Of guys, like young guys, they wanted to build from the ground up. So what they did is they made a trade to get basically some big names who were in bad contracts so that the product on the field was good. But at the same time, they invested heavily into the farm system. And if you look now, the Dodgers top players are all homegrown. They made the playoffs every year with those old guys who were getting paid a ton of money, but they now have young guys who are, you know, the future of baseball. And this is kind of like the PBC model that we've seen, or at least it's similar, where you make them in New York because you know in New York you can do a few million at the gate, and then you go back and grow them home locally. You combine that, a rabid fan base at home with a national fan base, and you have basically, you know, the ingredients for success, for stardom. And that's what we're seeing with Spence. Like, I definitely think, and I didn't see this coming, that Spence, I never saw this coming, that Spence would be a superstar or have the ability to be the next superstar of boxing. Obviously, we knew he was great and that he was, you know, everyone was going to love him based off of the way he fought, but I didn't think there was much outside of watching him in the ring. But they've done a really good job. I, through my estimations, the gate was over 2 million, which is good for a fight that wasn't in Vegas, that was a hometown. Nobody does, you know, multi-million dollar gates when it's a local fight. That's something you need to go outside of. Like, I doubt Terrence Crawford's doing 2 million at the gate in Omaha. Just saying. Not to compare the two, okay? I'm not trying to compare and put Crawford down, but I'm just trying to say it's a little different. You know, especially Dallas is a bigger market than Omaha. You can charge more for tickets, but it's just saying something. And the numbers also were similar to what Crawford does in Omaha, by the way. Anything else about this? Or?
Oh, yeah. I just want to respond to the very last point because, you know, we went off on this, like, very long discussion last time about ranking the stars in the sport and where all of them go. I mean, that is just a very interesting, I don't really have a conclusion, but an interesting thing where Spence's numbers in Dallas ended up being extremely similar to like Crawford's Omaha numbers. But, you know, it speaks to, but at the same time, Spence did, you know, better in New York than Crawford has. Spence hasn't fought a high profile fight in Vegas, not as a main event anyway.
Crawford has.
So, oh, sorry.
That's not a question, by the way. I'm telling you he has.
I'm sorry. I really missed where you were going with that. I was just saying Spence has not, saying, so I can't use that as a point of comparison to Crawford's.
I'm just helping what you're saying. Go on. Numbers. You missed it, but the listener got it.
Sure. Yeah, sorry. I was on a roll. But so anyway, interesting, you know, speaks to the differences in the market again. Like Omaha was totally ready to support Terrence Crawford at an earlier stage in his career. Spence fought in Dallas a few years ago with the Charlo brothers, and it only did 2,000 seats in a small venue called the Bomb Factory. So, you know, they dialed that back, you know, built up this New York territory, showcased Spence in that territory, had, you know, did pretty good numbers against Chris Algieri, did even better numbers against Lamont Peterson. And then, you know, by the time they go back to Dallas, last time it was 2,000. This time it's, you know, 12,000 plus. So, you know, just interesting trade-offs between the Dallas market and the Omaha market. And, yeah, very interesting things to come from Spence. I'll say again, it's like a little bit premature to be talking about, you know, superstar. I mean, look, I'm as excited as you are about it.
I said potential. No. I didn't say he is. I said potential.
Yeah. So, I mean, these are good but not, like, world-altering numbers. I think really more, I think what both of us think is this indicates extremely strong growth and extremely great potential, especially with the huge buy-in from the Dallas Cowboys organization. I mean, that really blew me away, like you were saying. You know, again, marketing to their ticket sellers, this partnership between, you know, the PBC and their side of their boxing organization with the Dallas Cowboys. I mean, I think that's going to be a match made in heaven for Spence and in Dallas. And again, if they can pair him with some Hispanic fighters, like they had, I think, a very serviceable undercard here, I think that's going to be a really good combination because PBC's been out of Texas for a while, you know, and they've got some good Hispanic fighters. I know, you know, always weird to generalize that, say, oh, you know, throw some Spanish-speaking fighters and you'll sell tickets in Texas. But, you know, I think that could be a good pairing if they could. I think, you know, whether it's Roman or someone else going forward, I think that'll be a good combo. Spence in Texas, get Hispanic undercard. I think that'll be good business.
Yeah, for sure. But you say that, you know, stereotyping or whatever you want to say, but the Hispanic fan base has driven the success of boxing for years. And any disagreement with that, that's just ignorance. That's just not really being in tune with what's going on in the sport. Real quick, we can touch on the undercard because I don't think that, I mean, I don't really think there's much to talk about in the Ramon or the Roman versus Flores fight. I thought Flores just looked pathetic from the start. I thought his knees were bending in very weird ways. Like, I wasn't sure if they bent inward or not, but Roman was skilled, no doubt about that, but it was made to look much, much, much better by the fact that Flores was just awful. I mean, everything was telegraphed. His knees bent inward, I believe. Like, literally, not inward like a bird, but, like, inward, like, sideways. Roman looked very, very good. But, again, I don't know how good he is. 122 is a real interesting weight class at the moment. Does he beat Ray Vargas? I think so. Does he beat... Who are the other champions at the division?
Well,
I can't remember.
Dogby and Neary.
Yeah, I don't know
well,
that he beats those guys.
Actually, did he fight at 122 or did he just come in overweight at
one?
At
no one knows what division Neary's going to fight at.
Yeah,
this
he's
guy
kind of all
weight?
Over the place, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Sorry, he's not really at that weight. He just, yeah, sorry, Boxrec is throwing me off because, yeah, he came in overweight for the Yamanaka fight. Yeah, but I think Dogby is kind of interesting. Still not sure how I'm supposed to get Dogby out of the way that it's spelled, but I guess that's how they pronounce it. Magdaleno got... got knocked out by Dogby in his last fight. I don't know how much anyone cares to see him again. Ray Vargas is super tall but awkward and just seems so weak. I don't know. I mean, look, I'm not going to sit here and say Roman is going to take over the division. I'd actually forgotten about him. He fought in a fun fight on Showbox at the beginning of 2017, beat up Adam Lopez.
Yeah, I was about to say Adam Lopez, yeah.
Yeah, and then he fought two fights in Japan, which were totally off. I mean, it was just like, okay, I mean, I watch every Showbox broadcast. So it was like, okay, I mean, I know I watched that fight. It was like, okay, you know, this is just a fun, like, super bantamweight fight. But I didn't really know how far he was from a title shot or if we'd see him. And he got brought to Japan, ended up winning a surprise title, WBA title, defends it in Japan. Wins that fight again. Now has this total washout of Moses Flores. I mean, look, there's a lot to like with Roman. I mean, great body work over the course of the fight. I mean, I really enjoyed just, like, talked about this before. There are some fighters who are just aesthetically, they're just fun to watch. I really don't follow the division closely enough. I mean, I know, you know, I've seen Ray Vargas, I've seen Dogby. I don't know if there are any other guys who are below the radar that I'm not aware of. And I really, like, haven't cared enough about those guys to say if Roman would beat him. But yeah, it was fun. I enjoyed the fight, and Diego de la Hoya is there, so it looks like it's going to be probably even harder for Diego de la Hoya to ever win a title because he, as much as I said, I don't follow the division closely, I'm pretty comfortable in saying all of them would beat him, and Roman is added to that list as far as another titleist at 122 who would beat Diego de la Hoya.
I don't know that I agree with that, but I do think de la Hoya and Roman would be a really good fight. Just a really nice combination of styles that are similar enough that fight at a high enough pace that would be actually a really good fight that I'd like to see. Not Ray Vargas, because I don't ever want to see him fight again. He should fight Flores. That would be a good fight. Let's move on. Javier Fortuna and Adrian Granados had a very strange fight. Fortuna falls out of the ring after having 2 points deducted.
Took a massive bump.
And hit his head on what was a photography?
Yeah, they kept saying on the broadcast, box? Originally I thought it was stairs, they kept saying a camera box. So I don't know what that means, if that's like a box that the equipment comes in. I think actually what it was, when they have the guys with the over-the-shoulder camera in the corner of the ring, I think that's what they stand on. Like,
yeah,
they don't stand
I
on
think
that.
That's, yeah, you're right. That's exactly what it was. And it just looked like... it was either that or he smashed his head back on the guy standing there, his camera or something. Either way, he ends up getting a concussion. And the only thing I really want to talk about is Granados here. Because I like Granados in, like, the meme sense. Like, I just like to laugh at him. And I just love it, how salty he is. But, like, the reality is that Granados is incredibly salty. And he's, like, not even salty at the right stuff. Like, these ugly fights that have weird decisions or scorecards or endings to them. What's the common denominator? Adrian Granados. His opponents are not the problem. He is. Like, really. Fortuna was going to win that fight if he didn't get himself knocked out or stopped. Granados was awful. He could, like, seriously.
He really did look terrible in that fight. I mean, it's kind of crazy.
I honestly, like, I, you know, I, like many, hated the Granados and Porter fight. Hated it. But, like, I'm sitting there watching this fight, and I'm like, you know, I might have been a little too hard on Sean Porter. Like, I know Porter, like, is really rough and smothers a lot, but Fortuna deserves some blame. Like, I thought that was all Sean Porter, but that's not the case. It was definitely some Fortuna. And then he's salty about the fact that Fortuna falls out of the ring when he's the one who pushed him and hits his head on something. And it's like, oh, yeah, he quit. He was avoiding me. It's like, dude, you were just rocked. Like, oh, Fortuna, the career featherweight, rocks Granados. Like, come on, dude. This is just a joke.
I just have to jump in. I love that Sam Watson, after, because, like, I mean, it was interesting also seeing the rap. I mean, credit, by the way, to the you know, folks running the game. And I don't know if that was anything to do with, you know, Dallas Cowboy people. Probably not. But anyway, you know, the medical professionals there, they didn't wait for the ref to say the fight is over. They're just like, this guy's injured. Let's get him out of here, which was nice to see, by the way. They really focused on the health of the fighter more than, you know, the theatrics of the sport. But yeah, I mean, when they got him, they're strapping him in. I love the camera goes back, and you can see that, like, Granados is, like, half hot, and Sam Watson is, like, hanging over his shoulder, just saying, like, basically, like, be cool. Be respectful. Say you feel bad that this happened. Because you could see Granados, like, they sort of pick him up on the mic. It wasn't, like, directly on him, but you could sort of pick up on the ambient mic, like, yes. He didn't want to fight me. And I love that, you know, you could see when they actually started the interview after the fight, Granados was kind of keeping it together for a minute. You can see, like, Sam Watson again is, like, right behind him, like, come on, Adrian. All you have to say is, I hope he's okay.
Yeah.
And I want, you know, let's do a rematch. And instead, he's, you know, he did that for like 30 seconds. Then he's like, he didn't want to fight me.
Yeah.
I just love that he could not keep a lid on it. Even and like just seeing Sam Watson's face as that was unfolding.
Yeah, he was just shaking his head a little bit, like just real subtle shaking his head, like, dude, please shut up.
Yeah, just my quick take on the fight. I really enjoyed it. Last week, I said this is going to be an ugly fight. Fortuna, who's
kind of ugly,
130 and 135. Well, yeah, but I mean, I guess based on my rock bottom expectations, I thought similar to when Fortuna fought Robert Easter, he was just going to have to, like, Granados was going to have such a visible size advantage. He was just going to have to sink the place out. And it's kind of funny, like, so to take the flip side of that, another way of looking at it, Javier Fortuna, when he was fighting at 130, was always, you know, the bomber. Like, people were really unsuccessfully, comically unsuccessfully, but trying to play him up that he'd be like the next Manny Pacquiao, that he was this guy with speed and power, and he had a lot of knockouts from when he was fighting in the Dominican Republic against really, you know, absolutely terrible opponents. But, you know, he's the sort of guy, very offensive minded, was always looking for there to be someone in front of him who would just absorb his power shots. And once he got further along and people kind of learned the book on him, people became good enough that they'd say, okay, well, I'm not going to sit here and just eat his power shots. I can kind of stink it out or box. And he showed some limitations there. And that's really been more the story of his career. So it was really interesting when he fought Adrian Granados. Adrian Granados has the size advantage. Granados entered the fight with the attitude, you know, I can just walk this guy down. And that ended up seeming just like everything Fortuna's always wanted, because Fortuna was just landing power shot after power shot, which was kind of hilarious, because also with the size advantage, it was like Granados didn't – I mean, Granados got a little marked up. He looked a little bit buzzed, but it didn't look like it was like heading towards a knockout. It was this weird thing where he had a much smaller like power puncher mentality fighter in Javier Fortuna, just being able to like – just, you know, I don't know if I'm overplaying this, but, you know, tee off on Granados. So very funny seeing that dynamic, and I was actually really interested to see where that fight was going to go. I hope they do a rematch personally. Again, I know it was ugly, but I thought, you know, not as ugly and bad as I thought. I would be very interested to see where that fight would go. It just seemed like a natural thing, you know. It's like they already made the deal the first time. It seems like Showtime would be interested in putting it on again. Like, let's do it again.
I think you're right that there would be a rematch, and I'm not interested in it. I think what we saw in this fight, there's nothing more we need to see. Do we need to see a winner? Does it matter if Fortuna wins? Is that going to convince you that he's going to win a world title? Likewise, or vice versa, if Granados wins, will you know that he's going to win a world title? I mean, these guys, I think they should be put in first of all, fights with guys that are their own size. Fortuna should not be at 140. I mean, even though he actually rehydrated a bunch, the weight seemed to be all like in his shoulders. That doesn't help you.
I don't know how to respond to that.
So I'm not too sure that this is a fight that I want to see a rematch. I mean, I thought it was okay, but like I just didn't like the fight. You know, I just felt bad about the fight because Granados was clearly the bigger guy. And it was going to be really tough for Fortuna to win that fight. I mean, he was landing big shots, no doubt about that. But at some point, if he gassed, it was over.
Yeah, definitely. I have nothing more to add with that. I do have. Before we move on, do you have anything else on the Spence broadcast? Otherwise, I have two quick hits on the Spence thing.
No, go for it.
Sure, very quick. So, you mentioned the IBF before about Spence. Well, you mentioned about Spence not rehydrating that much. I think that's another interesting point about, yeah, some people call Spence a weight bully. Whatever they see as knockouts, they say he's like super gigantic. Yeah, he's, as you said, extremely comfortable at 147. I think people who have said he's bursting out of the division, he's not going to be able to hold that weight. I think not reasonable to say that. And also, as we've said, another important, interesting feature of the IBF, they have the 10-pound rehydration clause for the day of the fight. So, you know, based on that, Spence is limited by how big he can get. So some combination of the IBF's rules and just his natural body size. But yeah, he is not super big. It's kind of interesting how 154 has these guys who are like 6'1", and 147, like Spence, is probably the biggest guy in the division. Not in terms of pure height, but just the biggest guy. And like he's only like 5'9 and a half. One other very quick and dopey thing. If anyone checks Reddit, it's still probably on the front page, you know, for the next day or so. I posted a picture last night, which was of Errol Spence with one of his sparring partners, who's a cruiserweight named Adrian Taylor, which looks really hilarious because, like, Adrian Taylor is just, like, 4 inches taller than him and just looks like someone shot, like, Spence with, like, an enlargement ray because he's just, like, exactly the same proportions but just bigger. And this is completely idiotic, but I just have to point this out. Someone made the comment, which is by far my favorite boxing comment this week, that it looks like Machop next to Machamp. And that was just so perfect. That comment got 291 upvotes, you know, and the picture itself got like, you know, similar amount in total. Just like that one comment just was like totally outdid my picture post. It's like,
oh my
damn
God,
man.
That's funny.
So that was Levin. Shout out to Levin on Reddit Boxing. Anyway, I think that's as much as I have to say about that event.
All right, so moving on, let's talk about the British card. We had Josh Kelly in the headline against Chris George, I believe. So we had four first names in the main event. And here's the thing about Josh Kelly. I know a lot of British fans are very hyped up about the potential of Josh Kelly. But one, I'm not sold, but I'm not going to sit here and do a whole like thing on why I think Josh Kelly's not good, because obviously anybody can emerge. We mentioned Isaac Dogbe earlier, and like that's a great example of like anybody can emerge. Anyone can be great. You just don't know. There are guys like Donyar Ulyasov who when they turn pro, we're thinking to ourselves, wow, this guy is going to be a star. And the reality is he's been unimpressive thus far in his career. Does not look like the guy who we
pretty
think.
Pretty nice highlight reel KO in his first fight. But yeah, his second fight.
Felix Verdejo has the greatest highlight reel of all time. Don't even at me about that, but tell me about Felix Verdejo.
Touche.
Okay. So, but that's, I mean, it's cool, I guess. But the point I'm making here is that while I may have a personal opinion about Josh Kelly, I'm totally willing to concede that I could be wrong about it. But anyway, moving on, from that part, I do want to say that it was a nice fight. The guy was clearly game who he was fighting, but Josh Kelly just, you know, he's more talented than him. I do think that there's a I thought if Kelly was he clearly doesn't have that upper tier power that I would have liked to have seen. I mean, he lands clear enough and clean enough that you would think he would get a stoppage in these fights, but you know, obviously it didn't happen. But I do think Josh Kelly's style specifically does need to change. He needs to get another trainer, because if I would say one thing about his talent that I'm not sold on, it's his ability to defend the way he's defended thus far against actual welterweights who, you know, can punch, can do a thing or two that, you know, a Chris George can't even, that I can't do. I can't even remember if that's his name or not. I'm starting to get real concerned. Well, I'm pretty sure it is
Chris, but it's spelled spelled with a K, so almost like he's part of the Kardashians or something. Yes, K-R-I-S, George.
Nice Kardashians reference. What did you think about the fight?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have that much to add. I have very mixed feelings about Josh Kelly. I just, you know, it's partly just a matter of expectations. I mean, Matchroom is trying to promote his fights while he's really coming up and just getting seasoned in the professional ranks as like events and real attractions, whereas really more of the US style, it's like, aside from Lomachenko, pretty normal to take 2 or 3 years, even for the highest level guys. Like, you know, Spence really didn't start to emerge until he had been a pro for a few years, and they really stepped him up. And I think, you know, we started off by talking about him. I think they really paced his pro career at exactly the right rate. Kelly, not ready for prime time yet. He's only 24. I'm definitely not willing to write him off yet, but Josh Kelly versus Chris George should not be presented as a ticket selling attraction. Doesn't really make sense to me. He has definitely more room to grow. And, you know, I think they got a little ahead of themselves with the Carlos Molina fight. I think maybe Hearn and his people a little too proud of themselves for getting a former champion on his resume, as his sixth fight, you know, but that didn't mean anything. You know, so that doesn't mean he's going to go out and he's ready for prime time to be, you know, this huge attraction. So, yeah, we'll see. Not ready to fight for a title. Definitely not ready to fight for a title in the super loaded welterweight division. I mean, my lord, I mean, Josh Kelly is in the same division as Errol Spence and Terrence Crawford. I mean, that would just be homicide if he stepped in the ring with
him. Yeah. So, you know, the lion.
Yeah. So he should go on the back burner. He's only 24. You know, let's see him get some more seasoning. But I think this weekend was more about that. I mean, I definitely was checking Twitter during the fight, and I did not see people who were excited about the fights. I mean, kind of, it's not the same situation, but kind of similar to Ryan Garcia's last fight. Ryan Garcia, I think a lot of people, his polarizing figure, people were a little bit
well,
mixed on his
last. Well, he's starting to be polarizing. That's not who he really is or was previously, but that's a whole,
well,
when
anyway,
he fights, we can talk about that.
Too much time about Josh Kelly, and I definitely don't need to start talking about Ryan Garcia. I'll let you move on.
Yeah, I mean, in all, I thought that this was a decent card. All the fights were pretty fun. The Lewis Ritson fight was pretty fun, obviously, for as long as it lasted. But the it's clear that Ritson and Josh Kelly is what's, you know, Eddie, I think, telegraphs his shots, what he's going to do. And this is another example of, like, this is so telegraphed. But anyway, we can move on. We will talk about now a tweet that I saw. I'm not going to say who tweeted it out because I'm going to disagree completely with what they said. So obviously I don't want to just throw them out there. But the tweet was something along the lines of so if you don't know, AT&T has merged or purchased or whatever. They've now acquired Time Warner. Time Warner owns HBO in addition to Turner Sports and Warner Brothers. So AT&T is now going to be the owner of those things. So what does this have to do with boxing? Well, so this tweet is basically deals with the fact that by AT&T purchasing Time Warner and therefore HBO, that the boxing budget will increase and HBO's boxing on the whole will benefit from this. This is complete and utter nonsense. It's just pure speculation, and it's not even good speculation, because the reality is that it's not going to happen. Okay? Now, how I know this is that John Stanky, that's literally his name, maybe it's Stanky. That's,
so you're not just disparaging someone, that's literally his name.
Yeah. I didn't even think of it that way. But
John Stanky. Anyway, yeah, continue.
So this guy's now going to be the head of the AT&T Entertainment Division, and that Entertainment Division will be Turner, HBO, and Warner Brothers. So he specifically come out and said, I am not interested in sports licensing. We are not interested in sports licensing. And he said that they wouldn't be spending a bunch of money on sports licensing because he does not believe in spending money on content that they will not own. Stanky is thinking of things on a global scale. Okay? He wants content that is available for HBO or TBS or whatever they own, that content that will be available across the world, because HBO is not just in America, it's in other countries as well. And the goal is that they want content that they can show everywhere so that they can get people around the world to sign up for the service. So think about Game of Thrones. Game of Thrones is HBO through and through. So they can put Game of Thrones everywhere around the world, and it's all going to be HBO. So the thing with HBO Boxing is that you have HBO Boxing, right? And that's how we watch it in America. But in Canada, sometimes fights aren't on HBO Canada. And you would think it's HBO Canada. Well, licensing. See, when you license a sport, it's network to network. You don't do international licensing where you make it available across all your platforms around the world. So that's a big thing that that just is complete nonsense that we're hearing that the boxing budget is going to increase. There was a quote that said that they were interested in increasing HBO's budget, but they were referring to the stuff that actually makes HBO money, the thing that is the driving force behind the subscriptions that HBO has, Game of Thrones, maybe. And he mentioned, what is he doing this weekend? Well, he said, I'm watching sports, and I'll be watching Westworld, binge-watching Westworld and Succession, two HBO shows. He didn't say HBO Boxing. He didn't say 24/7. He didn't say The Fight Game. He said those two things. Now, and I'm not trying to bury HBO. I'm not trying to do any of that stuff. But I'm just trying to say that this merger, the conclusion to draw from the merger is not that HBO will increase their spending. I don't know what would get HBO to increase their spending. Probably better ratings. Probably proof for them that the sport is worth investing in. So while I want HBO's budget to increase, because how awesome would it be if now we had bidding wars for fights? I mean, networks were throwing out king's ransoms for certain fights. Like, imagine if HBO was like, hey, Spence, we know that you're probably not going to fight Thurman next, but we're willing to throw out $6 million per guy for you guys to fight. That's more than you guys are going to make anywhere else. Let's see you do it. And that might convince some fights to happen. And I love it because, you know, HBO's production is still the best in the business. But that's not the news. That's not what was said. And that was just an inaccurate tweet. And I saw it was getting retweeted and people were discussing it. And it's just like, you guys are not based in reality right now. Do you have a response to that?
Yeah. Do you mind if I read the actual tweet?
Sure.
Sure. So this is, I'm just going to say, I don't know. I mean, I don't mind saying his name. This is Mike Coppinger, who, again, he came up earlier. I absolutely no problem with Mike Coppinger. But so this is his tweet. Could be huge for HBO's box. This is in regard to news of the merger. So $85 billion deal, this merger between AT&T and Time Warner. He's responding to that. Could be huge for HBO's boxing budget. Told a high-ranking official at AT&T is very bullish on the sport. And besides, HBO department budgets were tied up while the merger was being blocked. It really just feels like people apologizing for Peter Nelson just allowing the sport of boxing to evaporate while he's been there. Businesses spend money to make money. This is something we've talked about before, you know, parroting stuff that Stephen Espinosa has talked about. Stephen Espinosa has presided over a huge increase in the amount of boxing content on Showtime. He talks very openly that he has made the case within the CBS Corporation that boxing is good for business, that boxing brings in subscriptions, that he can tie new subscriptions to Showtime to high-profile boxing events. Yeah, that's how the business works. You know, they are showing boxing because it brings in subscribers. So if you know, again, within the corporate hierarchy, if you can make the case that spending this money will bring in subscribers, they will spend money doing that. Never really made sense that the money was tied up in the merger. I mean, if the executives at HBO really believed that boxing was going to bring in subscribers, they would spend more money on it. Now, granted, I will just throw out, HBO's situation is different than Showtime's. It's not purely a matter of executives. HBO has a lot more subscribers in general, and they have a much, you know, as everyone knows, they have a much broader and more successful level of content for their original TV shows and their other, you know, documentaries, other types of programs. They spend a lot more money on acquiring movies than Showtime does. So is it possible that, you know, Showtime has their case, HBO is their case, and it just matters more for Showtime because they have less of other things to attract people? I mean, that could be part of it. Also, definitely could be, as I've said, I mean, I think it has a lot to do with the executives involved, that Steven Espinosa believes in boxing, he's advocated for it, and he's really been able to make something for Showtime over there, whereas Peter Nelson has a very specific attitude, or seems to be, if you look, you know, just really an inch below the surface of what he's done, which is to spend as little money as possible on the boxing budget, which, by the way, is probably, you know, dictated above his pay grade. But, you know, spend as little money as boxing and try to just retain whatever level of viewers they can. I mean, they'll brag that even though they spent nothing on a Superfly card, they still got some nominal number of viewers. You know, that's an extremely different strategy than going all in on a boxing budget like Showtime and saying, look at all the new subscribers who are coming in. I mean, HBO is just, you know, really taking an attitude, what is the least amount of money we can spend and maintain some version of boxing as a feature for our service? So anyway, I really don't believe this, but who knows? I mean, you know, I'm not going to say Mike Commodore is lying. I mean, by the way these, I mean, this is phrased in such a curious way. He said he was told a high ranking official. He didn't say he has a source at HBO. So that could mean anything. That could mean a hobo on the street corner.
I'm told a high ranking official.
Yeah, well, or not even that he is. He said he was told that a high-ranking official said this, right?
Right,
so
right.
That just means I went up to Mike Coppinger at a fight, saw him on Press Row, and said, hey, I heard there's an official at HBO who thinks this. You know, this is like so many levels away from being like real reporting. So, yeah, we'll see what happens. I don't believe it. I mean, and as you got into, I'll just say very succinctly to reiterate what you were saying. Mm-hmm. Huge amount of fighters tied up at Showtime with the PBC universe, Al Heyman universe. Huge amount of fighters tied up at ESPN with Top Rank universe. Now you have the DAZN thing with real money dedicated, not a hypothetical budget in the future. Well, I guess there is some dispute about how hard DAZN's money is, but at least, you know, this money seems to have been earmarked. So if at some point in the future, HBO would have to decide they want to do it, allocate the money, it'd have a bigger budget, then work out these deals with these various different camps who now all have other homes elsewhere. So very, very, I mean, HBO's boxing has been on a huge decline, and under any circumstances, they are a long way away from turning that around.
Well, you know what's actually really funny is that boxing, for the most part, especially on HBO, but the ratings have declined pretty consistently over the years, and ESPN's ratings aren't stellar. They're not phenomenal to the extent that it offsets the decline. Okay. And I'm not talking about just HBO right now. Okay. I get criticized of being negative towards HBO, but I'm talking about the sport in general. The ratings are down. Okay. And I think it's funny that the ratings are down, and yet it seems now more than ever, we have more people, more networks trying to get invested and involved in the sport. It's a really odd dynamic.
Yeah, it is. I mean, there are reasons for it, but yes, it's strange just based on those, you know, metrics.
Yeah, so again, I don't think that the boxing budget is bound to increase by much at HBO, if at all. I think it's quite possible that AT&T, and I think that if we, let's say, you know, you, me, and the listener, whoever you are listening right now, us three, we took over boxing scene. Okay? Let's say we took over boxing scene. And we would take a week or two to just basically look at everything that they've got going on. So there's the outer part of their business, and their website that we actually see as consumers, and there are things that we don't know. And so let's say that we take a look at that stuff, and then we go back into the actual details that we don't see. And we look at all that stuff, and then what do? Well, we decide that we're going to make changes, don't we? And that's how it always goes. When new sports teams get new owners, they take a look at whatever the sport is, and then they fire the coach or they sign some free agents or whatever. And then they make their changes. They want their own people running things, and that's what happens. I think that's probably what's going to happen here with this purchase or acquisition, whatever you call it. AT&T is going to come and they're going to take a close look at all this stuff, and then we're going to see them unveil what they see, because their vision may not align with what HBO's vision was initially, you know. And we said Peter Nelson rightfully gets some blame, but I don't blame him too much, because while HBO's decline has occurred under his watch, I think that also boxing on the whole has declined. And, you know, if Peter Nelson is going to get criticism, then with the exception of Steven Espinoza, probably everyone else is worthy of getting some criticism. But on the whole, I do think that HBO's boxing specifically is in trouble here. And I don't know what the verdict will be, but it's in trouble because there's potential it may not be part of AT&T's plans. Now they're calling it Turner Entertainment or AT&T Entertainment or something like that. Whatever. Anything else you want to add?
Yeah, I mean, just look. When we did our star rankings last week for American boxing, Canelo was the clear number one. I mean, there's no dispute about that. It's not like HBO boxing is going to disappear. I mean, HBO is at least going to show Canelo's fights. HBO is, you know, very likely to continue to stay invested in the middleweight division. I mean, besides that, I mean, again, just to say is that, I mean, their schedule has been so shockingly barren this year. I mean, I didn't know we were even going to get into this topic, so I didn't prepare any numbers or any, but I mean, how would you say the number of cards they've had has declined over the last 3 years? I mean, isn't this by far their least active year? I mean, that I can remember. I mean,
yeah. So they've actually been very consistent, even up until 2016. But 2017, I think, was the first year where we saw a significant decline in the amount of cards put on. Although last year was clearly a departure in quality and name recognition. And this year has obviously been, you don't need to be, you know, a rocket scientist. This year has been pretty barren. I mean, we're going to have Alberto Machado headlining a card. His second card that he's headlining, I believe, in July, the end of July, but the week or two before the Dmitry Bivol and Sergey Kovalev doubleheader. So, yeah, there's that. I mean, I don't really have too much more I want to say on this, and I just want to make sure that this is really clear. This is not a criticism of HBO. HBO exists independently of what's occurring for the business on the whole. They're just a company, and HBO is a private company that happens to be owned by a corporate, or I hope I'm saying these terms right, a corporate company
just roll with it.
In Time Warner, and they've been bought by a huge company in AT&T, which, you know, this also brings up the subject of like, oh, now you have AT&T owning basically a piece of the entire media pie, and then you have Comcast Disney, who owns now a lot of Fox. Comcast is trying to buy off some of Fox's assets in the media world. I mean, things are crazy right now in that world. If you follow like this whole business side, I've been following it pretty closely because I obviously am super interested in sports media, as you can tell. And so I follow all this and see who's owning what and what ESPN is planning with their app. And there's, you know, you want to get into a conversation with that about me. I love this stuff. Let's move off of this because we have to talk about Canelo.
Sure.
I don't know what I did. I deleted my Canelo thing. I have no notes on Canelo. What a stupid thing to do. But here's what I wanted to say. Okay. This is very strange to like, I don't know how I want to say this, but what I'll basically just say is that
go for it.
It was all nonsense. This whole deadline, and then they the deadline passed and then they made the fight at the 12th hour when MGM came in. I don't fully buy it. And do you know who is like the fall guy here? I think that's the right term we're looking for. You know who's the guy who basically is making this all not believable? Actually, I already told you.
Curious to hear who you're. Go ahead.
He actually already knows. He's like trying to like work with me here. But it's Billy Joe Saunders. Because you know how they said they said in August that they were like they'd already locked in a fight with Billy Joe Saunders for August 25th at the Forum in Inglewood. Okay. Here's why that's nonsense. Because if Billy Joe Saunders really did have that fight with Golovkin and then they took it away from him, he would have said something by now. Like, Billy Joe Saunders is not that guy to hold a secret. This guy cannot keep his mouth shut. The guy's in, like, just, I don't, insert word here. He's a total that on Twitter. He would have let it slip.
I'm just going to jump. My wife got mad at me that I called him a crazy gypsy last week. She said that's not an appropriate thing to say on a podcast. I take it back.
I agree.
Anyway,
I agree with
continue.
Her. I agree with her. You are that you're crazy for calling him that. But the point, that's all the point, is that if this really wasn't like real, that they had a fight booked and then they're taking it away from Billy Joe, like you have to think Billy Joe would have been upset about that. I mean, this guy just canceled two fights. He canceled two paydays that were going to be pretty decent, and then he had a fight with Golovkin. Like, that's three fights that you had and lost? Come on. He would have talked. So there was no fight ever made. Maybe a preliminary discussion on it. Maybe a fight where it's like, hey, Billy Joe, if this fight doesn't happen, would you be willing to take this fight or negotiate a fight? And maybe he says, yeah, then maybe that's what they're talking about. But I don't think so. So what do you got to say about this?
Yeah, I am so all over the place with this. First, I mean, some combination of either I have to eat crow or I'm just like the biggest mark in the world because
it's both.
I've been going. Yeah, I mean, no version of this makes Tom Cody look good. But I've been saying for weeks that Tom Loeffler is, you know, an idiot. And he ruined. I don't think I called him an idiot, but anyway, just saying like he ruined Triple G's negotiating position. He shouldn't have taken the Marty Rosian fight, and then besides that, he should have taken a much more favorable split. That he was walking away from the best possible deal they could have made. You know, meanwhile they end up getting a great split by all accounts. And yeah, so that's great. And then as far as this, I guess inherent in me getting so wrapped up in this discussion over these various podcasts, I've definitely completely bought that this has been the way the negotiations have gone. This thing is just so fascinating. I mean, I really don't want to spend too much more time on this. We already got some complaints on our Patreon comments about, too much time on Canelo Golovkin, but I'm inclined to believe it regarding the Billy Joe Saunders thing. I think if you're wondering I'm continuing to just like drink. I'm continuing to just buy into all of this whole narrative. I mean, it would make sense as far as like why was Golden Boy willing to give those extra few percent, which is, that was one thing that I and we were right about saying, why is Loeffler doing this? He's not trying to get 50-50. That's never going to happen. But he is trying to get a marginally better split, which is what he ended up getting. So, to the extent if that's what he was trying to do, he succeeded. Why would that happen? What's been told said makes sense, which is that it was a combination of Hearn/Jacobs turned down the 80-20 split for that fight. So Canelo lost that option. And on the other side, Triple G was negotiating with Chris Eubank, which besides, giving Triple G another option besides fighting Canelo, would take away Billy Joe Saunders as a future opponent for Canelo. Canelo's a young guy, he's going to need more opponents in the future. So, it starts to make more sense why Golden Boy would come back to the table and say, you know what, we'll throw a few more cents, we said take it or leave it. At the 60-40, fine. We'll say, we'll give you a few more percent, take it or leave it, and then Golovkin finally did what makes sense. I really just don't want to spend more minutes talking about this, but that's my take. Any response?
No, I mean, you said it. The Patreon subscribers did complain. But to be honest, they so this podcast comes out once a week. The Patreon podcast comes out every day. And so I can totally understand if, like, there's some fatigue in discussing, you know, the same thing every day. But I do think I keep it fresh by, you know, bringing in different things. But anyway, I don't really think that there's anything much to talk about. The fight, I think I talked about, no, this was on the Patreon podcast. Sorry, I can't remember when I talk about things. But the thing that I get, basically, like, the whole gist of it was, like, there's only a few storylines for the rematch. And we've already talked about them because this is take two on the rematch. So, like, what else is there to talk about other than get in the damn ring, see who, please settle this argument, and then we can go on with our day. That's all there is with this fight. I mean, we can talk about what we think, but, like, I think it's, you know, real quick, I think it's going to be a repeat of the same fight.
I love the first fight. I'm looking forward to the rematch. Yeah, not much more to say. We already, I mean, you and, you know, many others and us on the website already got hyped up for it. For the, not just the first fight, the rematch on the original date. So, yeah, it's a little hard to come through with any more new takes besides all these shenanigans with the negotiations. Still a good fight, just not that much to say about it. It's been, you know, we've been speaking about it, just completely driving this topic into the ground for the last 6 months.
Yeah. Then Wilder accepts the offer from Anthony Joshua, which was a bigger news piece than it should have been. Wilder verbally accepts an offer that Eddie Hearn and Anthony Joshua made, but there's really no, like, evidence, or there's really no, how do I say it? Like, where's the contract? The fight isn't signed. All indication is that the intention is that they fight Povetkin. They don't want to take the Wilder fight just yet. Notice I said just yet. I did not say they don't want to take the fight, because I wholeheartedly believe that Anthony Joshua wants nothing more than to fight Wilder, just like I believe Wilder wants to fight Joshua. But business is business, and if they don't do the fight next, I understand. Just like if Spence doesn't fight Crawford or Thurman next, I understand. The name of the game is make money, and you make more money when you wait. If you just rush into things, you risk losing and not making as much money as you possibly could have made, but also you don't make as much money if you're not the star that you would be two fights from now. It's why, you know, Ronda Rousey joins the WWE and they don't immediately just have her fight the world champion. You take some time and let that bubble, let that percolate, because there are other pay-per-views down the line that you have to sell. Anything you want to say about this?
No, not really. I mean, I think, like, I'll just sort of repeat something that we've said on a past podcast and just relate it to the current news. As you said, it makes every reason for Eddie Hearn and Joshua to try to get out of this fight now. They don't want the fight now. Wilder does want the fight now. You know, he's older, he's much more in danger of getting injured or, you know, potentially losing. I'll just go ahead and say it. Wilder is a much more risky style. It's much more of a gamble every time he enters the ring. Conversely, Joshua, younger, they've got this whole new gigantic deal with DAZN, which, you know, we've talked about mostly related to the U.S. It does matter internationally as well. And I think Hearn and Joshua have effectively shaken this fight off for now without damaging their brand image too much. I mean, I think they spent a lot of time kind of, you know, dancing around this issue, trying to make it look like they weren't avoiding Wilder. I mean, even if you go back a few months, we're trying to make it look like it was Wilder who didn't want the fight, which, you know, never seemed plausible, but Lord knows they were British fans. So I think they have come far enough that I think people don't think that Joshua is ducking Wilder. They have come over to the idea that, you know, this is just complicated business, which is really what the truth behind the situation is. And one way or another, you know, it's just looking more and more like that Povetkin fight's going to happen. It always seemed like that fight was going to happen, and it looks like it's going to happen. You know, meanwhile, on the other side, Hearn has said that Wilder was very likely to fight Dominic Brazil. Looks, you know, continues
funny how
to look
the guy
likely.
Who doesn't promote or manage him is saying who he's going to fight.
Well, I mean, there are a lot of reasons behind the scenes why it would make sense. And I mean, especially now that, you know, White and Parker are tied up, Pulev's going to fight Big Baby Miller. There aren't that many, you know, appealing other fighters out there. So I don't think people in the U.S. are going to care. I don't think they would damage the promotion if Wilder fights Wilder fight. Can you help me out here? Well, he just fought Joshua. I just said his name a minute ago.
He just fought Joshua?
Well, he fought Joseph Joshua Parker? 2 years ago.
Oh, Dillian White?
Oh, my God. This is killing me. I hate that people have to listen to me stumbling
Dominic
over
Brazil,
this.
Dominic Brazil, Charles
Yeah, Dominic Martin. Brazil. Okay. Yeah, Hearn's been saying that.
See, I didn't. I could have easily said that, but I did not think that you would, that's who you'd possibly be referring to, because you literally just said his name.
Yeah, that's why. Oh, God. Anyway, yeah, just total brain fart. Anyway, sorry. Yeah, Hearn keeps talking about how Wilder's going to fight Brazil. He probably is. I really hope you can edit that, you know, like 40 seconds out. That was brutal.
No,
anyway,
no.
Hearn has been saying Wilder's going to fight Brazil. Wilder probably will fight Brazil. Everyone else has thought that Joshua's going to fight Povetkin. He's probably going to fight Povetkin. And just saying, yeah, the point I was trying to make about Brazil is Hearn has been saying this, and he's going to, you know, be patting himself on the back that, oh, you know, we told you all along Wilder is going to fight Brazil. Okay, UK fanboys are going to get excited about that. That's going to fire them up. No one in the U.S. is going to care about that, whether they fight at the Barclays Center, whether they fight in Alabama. Brazil versus Wilder is going to do just fine by, you know, Wilder standards, which are, as Hearn has said all along, are a fraction of Joshua's numbers. So we'll see what happens. The very final chapter of this crazy negotiation has not played out. You know, Wilder continues to make every concession possible to try to get the fight made, but it looks like it just isn't going to happen. So, you know, at a certain point, if it looks like he's desperate and is just following around Joshua begging for the fight, that's not good for him either. You know, it's not good for Joshua if it looks like he's ducking the fight, but it's not good for Wilder if he starts to look desperate. I mean, I was talking, you know, I spent a lot of time talking about that with the Triple G fight. At a certain point, I mean, Wilder needs the fight, but, you know, again, it's a tremendous show of weakness if he's showing all he has to do in the sport is beg Anthony Joshua for a fight. I mean, he needs to show that he can draw some money on his own. Anyway, that's definitely the end of what I have to say about that.
Yeah, and that leads us into a fight that nobody in America will care about. Derek Chisora versus Carlos Takam. It's a fight that I got into a major argument with. Like,
no one cares. Like a
first take style argument where I was yelling and the other guy was yelling. I'll say his name. It was Stu. We got into a shouting argument about this fight. And at the end of it, I was like, what am I doing with my life? Like, yeah, it's bad enough I spend so much time talking about boxing. We're literally shouting at each other about this fight. Because, well, Stu's argument is that Takam really sucks and Chisora's way better, or at least better. And I think Chisora really sucks and Takam is better than him. And so I'm not going
to
rehash the argument.
I agree with you. I don't.
I'm not rehashing the argument. I'm telling you, it got heated. Okay. It got heated. Like, cuss words were said and things like that. But the point is, it's a fight nobody cares about, but I'm not even going to get into it. But that fight is made, and it's you know, a fight that people are happy about in the UK. Next week, we'll be seeing Miguel Burchell return. He'll fight Jonathan Victor Barros, which is, I would say it's a little more competitive than what Spence Ocampo is, but still, Burchell is the major favorite here, very likely to win. Jonathan Barros is the kind of guy that you can always bring in. He's going to be tough. He's going to go rounds, and it's exactly what Burchell needs because he's still coming off of the injury. He's had delays. He's also extremely talented as well as young, and you know, it's very important, I think, that going forward, Burchell is promoted like a future star of the sport. I think whether this is right or wrong, Burchell needs to be treated.
I think it's wrong.
Burchell he's like gold right now. If you think about it, young, talented Mexican. As I've said in the past, said it earlier, the Hispanic fan base is incredibly important to the sport. it helps the sport. I mean, you can look at HBO's decline in ratings and match it and map on to the decline of Mexican stars that were on the network. And Berchelt is one of those guys that could be a star. You know, you may not like him. You may not understand what the hell he's saying. But realistically, you're actually a very small percentage of the boxing fan base. So now, obviously, he's not going to be Canelo, okay? Let's not get crazy. But as a consistent draw, like a Leo Santa Cruz, or even bigger than Leo Santa Cruz, or a Mikey Garcia, yeah, that's pretty good. And he captures the fan base that Mikey Garcia does not capture. So there's not much to talk about this fight, though, because it's not going to be that competitive. Anything you want to say?
No, I'll just add, I mean, I think Jonathan Victor Barros is better than you're giving credit for. There's a very clear favorite here, but Berchelt has fought, you know, if you look at just his last number of fights, I mean, he has definitely a number of, you know, worse opponents mixed in there. So, yeah, not great, but not the worst either. Probably a little bit below the level that you would want for a title defense. I mean, I don't think Barros deserves to be on the world level, but yeah, I don't think it's going to be. I don't think it's going to look like Spence Ocampo, I think.
Barros, oh, no, for sure. I mean, it's not even Berchelt style. I think this is not that, like, it's not going to be that one-sided. And also, that's just not Berchelt style. He's not going to go in there. And I mean, if you were to blow out Barros in one round, it would be a punch that's like, wow, like he could have landed that punch on anybody at 130 and it would have been a game changer.
Yeah, so we agree about that. I mean, yeah.
No, Barros is a tough guy. No doubt about it. He's a guy that you can rely on. He's not going to go in there and just be a complete jabroni. He's going to go in there and make an account of himself. Like he's a, like, I guess you could call him like a prideful fighter. He will not just go in there and settle with, you know, oh, I've gone two rounds, so if I get stopped here, I'm just not going to get up. He's not that guy. And then...
One last thing about that fight. So just 130, people got really caught up. For some reason, no one ever really seemed to want Berchelt versus Lomachenko when he was at that weight, at least as far as the mainstream U.S. press. All people really talked about was... the possibility of having the super young Gervonta Davis against Lomachenko, which was absolutely never going to happen. There's some decent fights to be made at 130. I haven't been super high on the division in the recent years, but I mean, you have Jezreel Corrales, who's serviceable, Francisco Vargas, who serviceable-ish. Miguel
serviceable
Roman,
is a good term for those guys.
Gervonta Davis, Miguel Berchelt, you know, very... you know, a little bit top heavy with Berchelt and Davis, but
you could easily make a pretty solid World Boxing Super Series. Now it would obviously be top heavy, but almost every division
So yeah, not a bad series of fights. I mean, a lot of good action fights in this mix. So you know, hopefully we'll see. I mean, Gervonta Davis is the guy in the division I'm personally most excited about. I guess. You know, maybe I'm showing a bias by being more excited about the American fighter than the Mexican fighter, but Berchelt delivers a lot of action. He's
no one would have ever
quite
guessed
a
that.
Fighter. Yeah, well, I've shown my preferences in a lot of different ways, but not a bad division. Looking like there are some decent fights to be made. I mean, it's shades of what happened at 140 when Crawford left. You know, Crawford was so highly regarded relative to everyone else, it kind of just sucked all the oxygen out of the division. Now that Crawford's there, there are some decent fights to be made between the people who are left. So, yeah, this isn't, as you said, not a super high opponent, not the worst either, much better than Ocampo. You know, as far as Barros, much better than Ocampo this past weekend. So, yeah, see, be a good showcase for Berchelt. He's the clear winner. And, yeah, hopefully we'll get more of these guys fighting each other the next 2 years.
In the UK, we'll have Josh Taylor versus Victor Postol. And so Josh Taylor is an interesting prospect. He looks very good. But here's the problem. Victor Postol is like a name that people will see on his resume and they'll recognize from, oh, he fought on pay-per-view against Terrence Crawford and didn't get stopped.
Pay-per-view fighter.
And
yeah.
He beat Lucas Matisse, who's now the welterweight champion of the world. you know, that's funny to say, and I feel bad.
One
but
way
it's
of characterizing
it's,
it.
Yeah, yeah, it's technically true. But anyway, my point here is that those people that say that did not see Victor Postol's last fight. Victor Postol's last fight was awful. Just truly awful. So people want to talk about robberies all the time. And you're like, oh, it was such a robbery. If you say that, like, you probably don't watch that much boxing. Because you want to see a robbery, go watch that fight. Go watch Postol versus, was it Kudratil Abdur?
I was going to say, yeah, I challenge
no,
you
it wasn't
to pronounce that,
that
name.
Was,
that is a lot of consonants.
Jamshidbek?
Jamshidbek?
That's
just, I'm just pronouncing
Kudratil
it phonetically.
Najmudinov.
Jamshidbek Najmudinov.
Yeah,
I'm not saying that to mock him. You know, I'm not saying foreign people have silly names. It's just objectively hard to pronounce that name in English. Yeah, it's an Uzbekistani fighter.
Right, and I've said it in the past. The Uzbekistani fighters are coming, and this was a really poor fight for Postol. Postol was dropped 3 times in the fight. Now he was only credited one of those knockdowns was credited against him. But it was very clearly, okay, very clearly, he was pretty badly hurt like 3 times. And
so,
somehow they did not score the knockdowns, and Postol gets this, like, here's even more so, okay? The scorecards were basically almost a shutout. They were almost a shutout. Think about that. This guy drops Postol, so he's good enough and landing like clean enough that he drops him 3 times, doesn't get credit for 2 of the knockdowns, and gets shutout cards, basically. Like, that was horrible. And guess where it happened? Of course, in Ukraine, where Victor Postol is from. So I'm not going to, you know, make this Ukraine conspiracy. It's not about that. I'm just basically saying, like, you want to see robberies, go to local fights where that nobody's really paying attention. Featuring a name like Postol, who's, you know, for all intents, a name. Everyone basically will recognize Postol if you're a casual boxing fan. And he gets this win over the guy who we're not going to say his name.
I think, yeah, we agreed on Najmudinov.
Does he have a nickname we can just call him by? The champ? Oh, his nickname is The Champion. Hilarious. I mean, go watch this fight, by the way. If you can spell his name out, look at the fight and then tell me Victor Postol won that fight. It's horrible, okay?
I just want to hop in very quickly. In his fight before that, Najmudinov fought an 14 and 11 fighter, 11 losses. The guy had lost his last 4 straight. And that was a competitive fight. Najmudinov had a competitive fight against a 14 and 11 fighter in his fight prior to that.
Well, that was a rematch,
a few fights
too, by the way.
Prior to that, he fought. I did not realize that. I'm not that up on Uzbekistani boxing. But in his fight, a few fights before that, he fought a 3 and 12 fighter, was taking the distance. I mean, this is when we talk about Ocampo was not good. We said that going into the Spence fight. This guy makes Ocampo look like Lomachenko, and he you know, Victor Postol very arguably lost to him. So, yeah, I just, again, I know I'm interrupting, but it's my very quick take on this. Victor Postol, if you really scrutinize his record, his resume prior to showing up on HBO, he had that hideous fight against Selchuk Aydin at the time. I heard more than one person say is arguably the worst fight that's ever been shown on HBO. Then he fights Lucas Matisse.
That's just not true, but go on.
Well, yeah, it doesn't involve the Hebrew hammer, so I guess probably not in consideration for worst HBO fight. But, you know, Selchuk Aydin versus Victor Postol, pretty terrible fight. Lucas Matisse fight, he got a lot of credit for beating Matisse. I think people would say, you know, Matisse said at the time he was injured, which, you know, granted, it means something if Postol induced an injury on Matisse, but okay, another way of looking at it is Matisse got injured, wasn't able to continue the fight, then fought Terence Crawford, not very competitive. You know, you go through his lists, like taking the distance by Hank Lundy, in a competitive fight, by the way. A lot of data points on his resume indicate not a very good fighter, and maybe Terence Crawford got way too much credit for beating him. Anyway, I was interrupting, but that's as much as I have to say about that.
I mean, look, we've made done a good job making a point here that Victor Postol is just not that good. But if you recognize a name and they have a little bit of prestige behind them, then people will just associate them as good. So Josh Taylor is going to fight Victor Postol and we'll get a completely inaccurate read on Josh Postol after this weekend, because I think, or sorry, not Josh Postol, Josh Taylor. that'd be an interesting combination though. But because Taylor's going to beat him, like I'm telling you right now, Taylor's going to whoop him. No doubt about it. I have no, like, just not even a question. He's going to whoop him. And people will say Josh Taylor's ready to beat Mikey Garcia or whoever the best is at 140 is. Maybe it's, who's the best at 140 at the moment?
Regis Progre.
Yeah, he's ready to beat Regis Progre, et cetera, et cetera. And it's like, are you kidding me? He just beat Victor Postol. Like, Victor Postol's aight, but, like, he's not that good. You know, and it's not fair to Josh Taylor, because here's the problem. Then people want Josh Taylor in these fights that he's not going to win, that he just needs a few more fights. Like, maybe he'll be competitive at some point, but right now it's not happening.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think Josh Taylor is a lot further along than another Josh we mentioned, Josh Kelly.
Oh,
two different divisions, but
definitely.
Yeah, I you know, I think I love this fight. I mean, as much as I said, I don't love Victor Postol. I don't love Victor Postol as, you know, an A side that I want. You know, I'm not going to get on the Victor Postol as an A side hype train, but I think it's a great opponent for Josh Taylor to fight in his 13th fight. Yeah, I like Josh Taylor. He's one of my favorite UK prospects. Yeah, I like him a lot. I saw him fight at the Barclays Center. He really not that was not as great his best performance. That was pretty ugly, actually. But, you know, in terms of
I've seen him in Vegas
fighting, yeah, not bad. I mean, he has a nice win over Harald Davis, which, granted, maybe not that impressive in hindsight. Victory over Miguel Vasquez, who's totally washed at the time, but still nice, put up some nice highlights in that fight. Yeah, I think this is great for this period of his career, and every indication is there's going to be a World Boxing Super Series at 140. Love to see Josh Taylor enter that.
Yeah, I think this is a good fight for Taylor. No doubt. I'm not saying that, like, this is a bad opponent. I'm just saying that the response won't line up with reality after the fight. But I like the fight for Josh Taylor. I'd like to see him beat a guy like Postol. Obviously, when you get to this point in your career, like Victor Postol, your job is to just get beat by guys like Josh Taylor on the rise. And that's kind of like how boxing has gone. So, yeah, that's it for that fight. And I don't think there's anything else coming up that we should talk about next weekend. I would remind
one last thing about the Postol fight very quickly. I mean, let's just remember, I mean, Victor Postol, neither of us love him, but he's the last guy to take Terrence Crawford the distance. So you have to say that if Josh Taylor knocks him out, that means something.
Yeah, it definitely means something, because the Uzbeki guy almost beat him. But anyway,
it means something. I didn't say what it means, but it means something.
Okay. And so I want to remind you guys, subscribe to the podcast, first of all, and then follow is the word I was looking for, on Twitter, on Instagram. I also do want to say that we're supposed to give out a free t-shirt to someone. And I haven't done the work to figure out who the winner is. So we'll announce that on Twitter, and we'll get a t-shirt out to you of your choosing. Apparently, what I found out is that from someone in the chat, they said that the Errol Spence store, they ordered a shirt 3 times from the store and they never got anything. So not to get any Errol Spence gear, just because it's not very reliable. So we'll just open it up to, like, basically any shirt you want, any boxing shirt you want, we'll open it up. So I'm going to look, I'll announce it on Twitter and contact you. And that'll be it for this week. You can subscribe if you want more podcasts, more boxing discussion. Subscribe on patreon.com/sundaypuncher. Definitely subscribe, rate, review the podcast. You can follow us on Twitter, on Instagram. You can join our boxing chat. You can discuss boxing with us. You want to talk about music with Tom and share Nas's new album and tell him why he should listen to it. Definitely do that. So thanks for listening. Tom, thanks for coming on. I hope
no problem.
You I hope you were okay with all the business talk. I know that that's not your thing.
Yeah, I had fun time on. I just want to shout out. I don't know who has a beef with Errol Spence's store. I have two Errol Spence shirts. I had absolutely no problems with it. Yeah, from the whatever Errol the Truth Spence, whatever the website is.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow. Okay. Well, you know, we'll have to sort that out.
I mean, I think
out.
It's like a Shopify website or something. Like, I don't think there's anything like problematic about it.
Man, what do you know about Shopify?
Exactly as much as I just said. I know that it is a thing. But yeah. Anyway. Yeah, I look forward to someone's going to get a cool t-shirt. I think we're maybe giving people a little bit too much power if you're saying they get to pick their shirt.
Well, if it costs too much, I'm going to tell you, like, no, dude, that's too much. Like, you're going to spend all of our money, and we're supposed to buy other things with that money. So we'll be back in next week, actually, unless you're a subscriber. Then I'll be back tomorrow.
Talk to you later, guys. That's what you're playing us out on. Did you know that was going to drop?
This is what the people like, Tom. Get with it.
Okay. You got to give the people what they like. You gotta.